This is Jason Horsey for the New Books Network. Today I'm talking to James A. Davidson, the author of Hal Ashby and the Making of Harold and Maud. That's from Macfarlane Press. Jason here.
Hi Jason, how you doing?
Good, can you hear me good?
Yeah, fine.
Thanks for agreeing to do this interview. As I said, it's going to be for the New Books Network. And I guess we'd just start with the genesis of the book. Like, how did you end up writing a book about the making of Harold and Maud?
Well, it was about 3 years ago. And I'd really just always been a big fan of Hal Ashby, who was the director of the movie. I didn't see it when it first came out, Harold and Maude, because I was 13, so I was a little bit young. But I saw it when it was first re-released in 1974, when it was given a re-release by Paramount. And so, you know, I'd been a big fan of the movie. I'd been a big fan of Hal Ashby, the director. And I really wanted to write something about him and his career. And about 3 years ago, I found myself in a situation where I was working out of my home. I had a little more time on my hands. I'm not a professional writer, full-time writer. I have a video production company, actually. And we closed our studio down. I was working out of my home, so I had extra time. So I said, well, I just kind of out of the blue, I said, I think the time is now. And I settled on Harold and Maude because I thought it was a movie that a lot of people like myself had loved, you know, for many years. A lot of people had been interested in. There's, of course, a cult following. The movie just had an interesting history, had an interesting several storylines behind it that I thought were interesting, and I wanted personally to find out more about. So that all kind of was what brought me to it, and I started at the Margaret Herrick Library, which is a pretty well known place for people that you know do film history and do kind of behind the scenes and making of books. It's a library that's in Los Angeles. It's a arm of the Academy, you know, Academy of Film Arts and Sciences, and it's a place that's the studios store their film records there. They basically send over their production files and whatnot. So I started there with them, and they were open to me, you know, coming in and going through the files on Harold and Maude, Hal Ashby, and so I started there.
And did you try to talk to all the surviving members of the film production?
Yeah, I you know, that's a challenging thing. The movie has it came out a long time ago, of course. It's 45 years old, and I did endeavor to talk to as many people as I could. It's a little bit difficult. Sometimes it's hard to locate people. Sometimes it's hard to get people to talk to you when you've located them.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, so that's a challenging aspect of it. But, yeah, you know, you definitely have to do that, because otherwise it just becomes, you know, more of a an exercise in research, and that can, you know, you want to get the personal side of it. So yeah, I undertook trying to reach out to as many people as I could. Tried to contact Bud Cort, and didn't end up being something that came to fruition. But
did you get any response
from Bud? No. No.
And you mentioned in the book that he just doesn't want to talk about Harold and Maude at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he'll do it, I guess, under certain circumstances, but I guess it just wasn't right for him. I guess, you know, I don't want to exactly speculate on what is. But I tried emailing several times, and I had several people who told me that they would reach out to him and try to encourage him to speak with me, and I never heard from him. So that was that. So,
too bad.
You know, but you have to carry on. You know, you can't. Obviously, he was a major figure. I would have liked to have. I reached out to Chuck Mulvihill, who was the producer of the movie and who was a longtime associate of Hal Ashby's, and tried to contact him. He would have been a great source, but unfortunately, he was kind of non-responsive to me also. So that was the negatives. On the positive side, I did speak with several of the people who were in the movie. Ellen Gear, who was Sunshine in played Sunshine, one of the dates that Harold has. We had a very nice back and forth about the film. She gave me a lot of nice information. I spoke with Tom Skerritt, who was played the motorcycle cop.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was who it was until I read your book, which is remarkable. Well, it's not remarkable because he didn't take credit. But even the fact that I didn't recognize him is remarkable, because he's actually, in a way, almost certainly one of the biggest celebrities in that film.
Yeah. I mean, he's had the best career, certainly, of pretty much all the people that were in the film. Subsequently, I mean, he's been many movies and television shows. So, you know, he took time to talk with me, and My wife was a great help to me. She helped me track down some of these folks, which is really helpful. So, he lives up in Washington State, and he gave me a call, and we had a nice conversation. And then I tracked down some of the people that had smaller parts. I tracked down the lady who was Ruth Gordon's stand-in, or her, not her stand-in, her stunt double. She lives up in Idaho. I got her on the phone. We had a nice conversation. I did everything I could to get in touch with as many people as I could. I had a lot of help from a guy named Jeff Wexler, who was the production assistant on the movie. And it was his first movie that he worked on. He's the son of Haskell Wexler, the cinematographer.
Yeah.
And he was kind of Hal Ashby's, you know, sort of his right-hand man, I guess you'd say. You know, he was young. It was his first movie he was working on, but he kind of was the jack of all trades. He did everything. So Jeff was kind of my go-to guy for if I had a question of something that was I couldn't figure out.
So was that your first experience of trying to make contact with people in Hollywood or in the film world?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. It was a new experience for me. And it was interesting. It had some, you know, there were some really interesting, fun things about it, and, you know, there were some things that were frustrating. I mean, when people wouldn't, you know, they don't return your calls or return your emails, you know. It's a little perplexing, and you're like, well, gee, what can I do now, you know?
Yeah, that was why I asked, because ever since I was a teenager, really, I wanted to make it in Hollywood, and then in my 30s was when I actually began trying to establish connections, because I'd written a book and Pauline Kael had favored it, and so it felt like there was a little bit of an opening there, and I did everything I could. I even actually physically went to Hollywood, And I continued off and on for about 10 years, but it was incredible how frustrating it was, and how in the end how utterly futile. And I'm actually thankful for that, actually, in the end. But I just mentioned it because it really is it's an uphill climb for sure, just to try and get to contact the gods, so to speak.
And you have to understand. I mean, you have to tell yourself, look, you know, these people have a lot of people that might be wanting something from them, one reason or the other. You know, they're dealing with a lot of people, and if someone comes in from totally out of the blue and is like, hey, you know, talk to me, this and that, the other thing, you can understand why there's going to be a degree of guardedness about it. You know, so.
Yeah, or just the lack of interest, because there's nothing actually in it for them, really.
Yeah. I think some of the people helped me. I mean, Tom Skerritt told me, you know, I called because I saw your letter, and, you know, you're writing about Hal, and Hal was just a mentor to me, and when I was starting out my career, Robert Altman and Hal Ashby were the two guys that just, you know, really helped me get going, and so... You know, he responded because my focus was on Hal, you know, and he kind of felt, I guess, in a sense that he owed him something, you know, in that way. So
right.
It's real hit and miss, though.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk about Hal in a little bit, but let's start with the movie itself. I'll tell you why I'm talking to you now, why I ended up getting the book and reading it, and that is, well, two reasons. One, that it was my favorite movie as a teenager. It was the same, it's quite sort of incongruous because it was the same period that I discovered Clint Eastwood, so I'm not sure whether it was before Dirty Harry was my favorite movie or after, but, you know, very, very disparate kind of types of thing. And so generally I was into the violent action movies and stuff as a teenager. And horror movies, but I discovered Harold and Maude through a friend of my sister, and he recommended it, and then because it was on TV, and I recorded it, and eventually I watched it, and I remember it was a very slow starter for me, like I was quite bored to begin with, and then little by little it took me over, and by the end of the movie I was completely enamored of it. And then,
right.
I showed it to my best friend at the time, who was also a Clint Eastwood fanatic, and he had the same response. And it was actually, I remember, it was the moment that I knew he was getting it was with the when Bud Cort turns to the camera when he's just done one of his fake suicides and chased off one of his dates, and this, I just found out that he improvised this, but he's smiling knowingly at the camera, and the Cat Stevens song. Beginning with the piano, and that was the moment that my friend, it might have been for me as well, like it got him, right?
Right.
And so by the end of that second viewing with him, he also was completely enraptured, and it became our favorite movie together. And so that was, you know, it had a really major impact on me. And then recently, my niece, who's 20 now, so it's probably a little bit later than it was for me, but around, I would guess around 16 or 17, she discovered the movie and it became her favorite movie, and she became even more. I mean, I was a pretty devoted kind of follower of movies, there's no doubt about it, but the way that my niece took to Harold and Maude was off the chart, really. I won't even try and list the examples, but she just became completely enamored of the movie and of Bud Cort, and so it kind of, there was a second generational thing,
right?
There, it was like something coming around again, like a planet, you know, it's been there before and it's done its cycle and it came around again. So yeah, as you know, it is this movie that has this uniquely profound effect on people, and it seems as though it's not a product, it is a product of its time, but it's not dependent on its time to have that effect. Like, we're talking 45 years later and it still has this power to deeply impact a teenage girl and be a life-changing movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I tried to point out in the book that, I thought that I think they were really wise to sort of stay away from a lot of the political messaging that was going on in the early 70s, and they really tried to almost go against the grain of that and make it about these people and their lives and their relation to each other and to life and death. And as a result, it really has a timeless quality that's, helped the movie, hold up for years and years, as opposed to some of the other ones from that late 60s, early 70s period when Vietnam was going on and whatnot. And those are much more dated films, none of which come to mind right at the moment. But.
Yeah, and the countercultural ones, the ones that are promoting the countercultural values. Harold and Maude actually wasn't really doing that, even though it intersected with some of those values, and it certainly would have appealed to the counterculture. But as you say, it wasn't actually riding on the back of any of that. It was a more archetypal story that was addressing, deep psychological realities, I would say. I mean, this is in retrospect. I certainly didn't think about it at the time. I'm not sure how much I questioned. I know that, obviously, I identify with Harold as an alienated teenager, somewhat obsessed with death, I think I was even then. But I also remember that Maude was the character that I most wanted to be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was interesting in researching that, I think Colin Higgins, the writer, he really took the time to develop that character. In the early drafts of the script, She's just an older lady that, gives him a kind of a, feel better about yourself thing. But he really attempted to develop a philosophy around her, and it interested me to find in the in his collection at UCLA that he had all these pamphlets of this. Philosophy that Maude adopts. He'd studied it. It was an actual philosophy that exists, and people out there that follow it and whatnot. And it had all the tenets of what Maude talks about in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't by accident, that this character's so resonant with people.
And that was theosophical?
Yes. Yeah. And I knew there was something there, and nobody, as far as I knew, had ever kind of put their finger on it. And some people said, oh, she's got a Buddhist philosophy, and I looked at that, and I went, nah, she doesn't exactly have a Buddhist philosophy. So I looked at several different sort of philosophical, I'm not a philosophy expert by any means, but, I looked at it, and I said that, none of these exactly fit what she does. And then when I was researching Higgins, I found these pamphlets that he had, and I looked into it, and I went, this is exactly what Maude, some of the things she says comes almost straight, chapter and verse out of their little text, and it was interesting to me that I was able to make that connection, and I really think that's why the movies got such a resonance with people. It's based on stuff that's kind of deep,
So were they written by Blavatsky then, those pamphlets? Were they actual excerpts from her work?
Yeah, there was excerpts from texts that she had written, and that were part of the Theosophical Society. So I haven't gotten any of the books myself and read them, or I'm not sure they're in print anymore or anything like that.
Oh, they are. It was one of the most interesting things in your book for me was because I have read Blavatsky. I read The Secret Doctrine, which is I don't know how many pages long, 2,000 pages long, and I've even incorporated it into my own beliefs for a while until I began to see, certain aspects that I really didn't want to embrace. But it's also I think it's very significant because Blavatsky, if you trace back the sort of cultural and philosophical trends, then Blavatsky, in many ways, was the source of the New Age and of the counterculture. The New Age movement was post-counterculture, but she was really an enormously influential figure in terms of how her ideas were adopted and adapted by other groups and other movements and other this, that, and the other, and how they basically run through all of these more well-known kind of movements, whether it's Est or what have you, you know, there's countless ones, Esalen. So in that regard, it was like Higgins instinctively went to the source of something.
Right.
I mean, some kind of wisdom. I'm not sure what I think of Blavatsky at this point. Obviously, he distilled the essence of the most life-affirming aspects, because there's a lot of Blavatsky in that's very complex and quite like there's racial theories and all this stuff that would be considered pretty questionable today, right? But Higgins was writing this solar Earth Mother solar figure who is just affirming the beingness of life or the goodness of life. And it seems like it doesn't seem to belong to any kind of system. I mean, her Moore's wisdom seems just like common sense and it's just an embracing of life. That was the thing that I wanted to emulate. I wasn't thinking, oh, Maud has figured it out or she's got this great philosophy. It was just that somehow she'd discovered a way to just live in the moment and embrace life unconditionally.
Oh yeah, no doubt. It absolutely works. I mean, in the context that he used it, I mean, it worked so well. And the fact that, you know, he contrasts it with the character of Harold, who's, you know, totally kind of almost you feel like he's given up on everything, you know. And yeah, it's brilliant, you know. And that's the thing. They were making movies at that time where they were able to do these sort of character studies that are so interesting, you know. Harold Maud really represents it very well, you know.
Mm. There's another aspect in the story. You didn't really write about it, but and that's Harold's relationship with his mother. I mean, of course, you wrote about that, but in terms of what we're talking about, the sort of deep psychology and the archetypal nature of the story, that, you know, Harold's inability to live and his attachment to death, I think, is inseparable from his bondage to his mother. Like, he's actually still inside her psyche, in a sense. So she's controlling him, and his only way to rebel is to reject life, really, and to embody this deathly kind of character.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he literally has, you know, The suicides themselves, they don't have any meaning except for as little, you know, performance pieces for his mother, you know.
Yeah.
He's not going to do them for himself, you know, or even anybody else, you know. It's got to be her that sees it. And it's just so, you know, yeah, so simple but so great. I mean, so memorable the way, you know, it was done. And yeah, the casting in the film of using Vivian Pickles as the mother I don't know, it's just so right.
Yeah, it's a remarkable performance.
You go, how did he get it so right, you know? And the other interesting thing about her was the fact that it's very tough timing-wise with her, because she was making another movie at the time. I think it was Nicholas and Alexandria she was in, and she had a few weeks break from that film, which was a big epic costume picture, and they had a very narrow window of time that they were going to, you know, that they could be in the house that they used in Hillsborough, and apparently it was a real you know, tough, because she didn't get there. And for the shoot time, you know, they were going to have to dispense with her as the actress, which would have been tragic as the film goes, because she kind of makes it on some levels, you know.
Yeah.
And they had some problems with immigration, which is like, wow, you know, that was That was a tough bet. But you know, those little things, you know, those are the kind of things I wanted to, you know, that came out in the book that I wanted to kind of highlight. And it was great to be able to discover stuff like that, you know.
Mm.
But those little dramas that occur behind the scenes, you know, that you never know about when you watch the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the stuff that I enjoyed being able to find out and put in the book. But yeah, she's magnificent, and it's really a great part of it.
Has she passed away now?
No, she's still alive. She lives in England, and I didn't really make any attempts to get in touch with her because I had no clue how to.
Right, where to begin?
She's still with us. Yeah.
Remarkable.
90 something years old. But,
wow. So how many times have you seen Harold and Maude now, then, would you say, as a guest?
I've seen it. I've seen it several dozen times. I haven't seen it as many times as a lot of the people who are huge devotees, and you know, some people say they've seen it hundreds of times, and I can't say that. For me, I wanted to get the story behind the film, and I love it. But for me, it's one of many films that are among my favorites. So it's not my absolute favorite movie of all time. I'm a huge Alfred Hitchcock fan. But that's how I really kind of came into film study. Was through Hitchcock and growing up with those movies, you know, Vertigo and Psycho and North by Northwest, movies like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up at film school, of course, but I have seen the movie many times and under many different situations, and kind of like you, I kind of, especially when I was younger, I would sort of bring people to the movie, you know, if I knew somebody, I'd say, oh, you know, let's go see this movie. You know, you've got to see it with me. You know?
Yeah. Well, that is how Harold and Maude actually has become the phenomenon it has become, is largely through word of mouth, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It got popular on college campuses. It got shown it's an absolutely grassroots type of phenomenon, you know. It's people seeing it, telling their friends, bringing their friends. That is the kind of incredible part of it. It's not something that it was an absolute flop when it came out, you know, but it's just been years and years of people seeing it and loving it and relating to it and kind of bringing people to it, like I said, you know, and then them embracing it.
Yeah, and everybody has their Harold and Maude moment. You know, there's the thing in the movie that stands out for them, and they'll tell somebody else that moment. And it's the quality with which people speak about it, I think, because people recommend movies all the time. But,
right.
You know, when I was told about this movie by my sister's friend, there must have been something about the way in which he talked about it that communicated, obviously, his passion for it, and that there's something, to use the modern term, it's viral, it's infectious, it's contagious, is that passion.
Yeah. We had an event a few months ago at the Western Railway Museum where they have the rail car that was used as Maude's home, and we had an event there. We had a book signing event also, a gentleman has reproduced the Jaguar hearse that Harold drove, and so that he brought that there, and I did a book signing, and people could tour the rail car, and I was just I was blown away at the number of people that came from all over. It's in Northern California, and people that came and dressed up and. You know,
yeah, yeah, right.
I was like, wow, this is this is crazy, you know. It was really cool. It was fun, you know.
Didn't the Jaguar hearse get driven off the cliff at the end?
Oh, yeah, it did. This is a reproduction.
Oh, okay.
A gentleman named Ken Roberts, who is very interested in cars and film cars, he decided to do a fully accurate reproduction of this, of the car, which was demolished, yeah. And he spent a ton of money on it, and it's really kind of an amazing thing, because you have to fuse together a Jaguar with a hearse. I don't know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it's very interesting. He takes it around, and he shows it at car shows, and he shows it at events. The week after we did our thing, he took it out to Pacifica, which was where the car actually went over the cliff, and they had a thing out there called the Fog Festival, which is, it's just a community event. It's not a film thing necessarily or related to the movie, but he took it out there, and he said he had a ton of interest of people that, you know, taking pictures and relating to him how the movie, and they loved it, da, 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 you know. So,
and this includes the younger generations, I presume. It's not just people who are...
Yeah, it's a lot of people my age and a little bit older that saw it when it first came out, but yeah, it's their kids, it's their grandkids, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's people showing it to their kids and grandkids and them taking part in it too. So,
I was thinking that the trajectory of Harold and Maud. I mean, it was unusual for its time in terms of, okay, so it was a movie that was unlikely to get made and was a gamble for the studios, Paramount. Robert Evans was the risk-taking, you know, youngest mogul or whatever ever, and so on.
Yeah.
So it had the right climate for it to happen, but there was the hope and even some expectation that this could be a great hit. Then it was as though the studio backed away from their own product because they marketed it so poorly that it was guaranteed to fail, and it did. And then there was this thing of the word of mouth, you know, word getting around, and repertory cinemas or just normal cinemas just playing it over and over again. And so it was the movie actually had a life of its own beyond the studio, the financial apparatus that was supposed to be supporting it. It was as if it was able to live off that support, or independent of that support system. It had its own life. And so then it eventually became a cult film, and then it was re-released, and so on and so forth. So that phenomenon is rare enough even for that period. But would you say that it would be as kind of unheard of now? Like that trajectory just doesn't happen anymore, does it, with movies or...
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, it's different now, of course, because the entire landscape of film distribution is totally different. You have the element of home video that didn't exist at all back then. So now you get movies that get a second life on home video, because that's a way for people to see movies that aren't huge hits, or that, you know, they don't necessarily see in the theater. So that aspect, of course, didn't exist with Harold and Maude. But I did want to point out, in the book, that it did benefit from the fact that because the film distribution was changing at the time, and that there were a lot of these theaters that had sort of been left behind by the transition to big multiplexes.
Mm.
There was one theater in Minnesota that ran it two straight years, that ran it for like 1,900 straight showings or something like that. And this was a movie theater that had been, you know, kind of left behind as they converted the old cinemas to multiplexes. They would just add screens and build the theater out, you know.
Mm.
But some of them, you know, a lot of them didn't have the benefit of that. They were just kind of movie theaters that were not just single screens. They weren't doing much anymore. They weren't doing much business. Those are the theaters that really were showing Harold and Maude, in the 1972 to 1974 period like crazy, you know.
Right.
You know, if it hadn't had those theaters to access, I mean, if it had been released in 1951, let's say, instead of 71, it would have kind of missed the boat because there wouldn't have been that distribution channel for that, for the film.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it got lucky in that way, kind of timing-wise.
Yeah, yeah, that's very interesting because those theaters also had, they benefited from movies like Harold and Maude because it gave them a new function, just as their old function was becoming obsolete.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, would you get a movie like it nowadays? No, but you know, you do get oddball movies that people pick up on that they don't get when they're first released and that, you know, they pick up on them later, but it's just a little differently. You know, now it's, you know, home video and pay-per-view and, you know.
And the community is on the internet rather than actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, there's the streaming and there's, yeah. You know, people are able to talk to each other easier now. You know, you can tell somebody, you can put something online and somebody sees it halfway around the world, you know, so. There is a communication that wasn't there, you know, back then. And I guess in a sense that makes it even more amazing that the movie did take off as it did when you really didn't have any. It literally had to spread word of mouth. You know, it couldn't be viral at all. You know, it had to be people telling other people. You know.
Yeah, face to face, pretty much.
But Paramount, to its credit, I mean, they did re-release the movie several times. I mean, they didn't throw it on the ash can. They didn't, you know, burn all the prints or some of the other things that studios have done to movies. And they did, you know, figure it out when they realized the market was happening for it. And they several re-releases of it, and the movie eventually got into the black and made money. And, so for what that was worth.
So have you thought about how much the taboo aspect of the movie was responsible for its impact? Because, like, obviously it's about sex and death, and
right.
Death is a taboo any way you shape it, really, unless it's just James Bond killing people. But, I mean, really, a real confrontation with death that Harold and Maude is about, that's a taboo always. But then the sex is a taboo because it's a 20-year-old and an 8-year-old. Which is kind of almost like the least important aspect of the movie in some ways, or it's not one I think about very much when I think about Harold and Maude. It's weird, you know,
right.
that is somehow shocking. And it still is, I suppose. I mean, there hasn't been anything equivalent to that in terms of improbable relationships.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, it worked for the movie and against it. I mean, at first it worked against it because it was so oddball, you know, the various things that you've mentioned. I mean, it turned a lot of people off, of course, at first. The early 70s was still a time when people were a little bit, you know, it was just more of a straight-laced time, I guess you could say. The walls were coming down, but they hadn't come down at all the way, and so it worked against it at first, and then it started, I think, working for it because it was so different. And but you're right, the sex part of it is not a major component. I mean, their relationship develops first, you know, and he obviously falls in love with her as a person first, and then it comes, you know, as a secondary part of it. But it was a big issue when they were making the movie, you know, how much of this do we show, you know?
Absolutely.
A lot of studio resistance, obviously, to showing anything. But
it's almost as if they had to have it because otherwise it would have seemed that they'd backed away from that. And I think that's true that it is, you know, you don't want to just deny the sexual element, but But it's also as though it's kind of incidental to their relationship somehow. I mean, I guess it would be for her, for Maud. She's not really going to be that interested in sex in her 80s, I don't suppose. Yeah, generally. So it was. I suppose it was necessary for Harold's initiation.
Right, right.
More than anything. Yeah.
I would totally agree with that. You have to, you know, you have to have it. It's part of it. It was not in the original script, as I recall, when he was writing it as a student film, but it was, you know, when he expanded it and it became a feature length, and he included that aspect of it. So, I do think that it was a tricky part of it for them. It was something that, you know, they had to deal with. But for the trailers, they had the trailers apparently showed more of the footage that was shot.
That's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, and that caused the studio to completely pull the trailers and not use them.
But they must have decided to put it in the first place, or at least allowed it. So it was some gamble that they realized was misconceived.
Right. Right.
So it's bizarre, actually.
Yeah. It was, you know, you have the entire thing of the people making the movie were really kind of in the counterculture, and the people paying for the movie, you know, producing the movie were not. They were viewing it as a commercial endeavor. So there was a pull back and forth on that.
Mm.
But to some extent, I think the movie was a victim of it by virtue of the fact that it was then not advertised quite the way it could have been.
Mm. Well, it's a difficult movie to sell, no doubt. Even today, it would be difficult,
yes.
I think.
That doesn't fall into any categories.
No.
Genres.
No, and I think that that's actually what... I mean, of course, that's what makes it unique, but I think it's also what is inseparable from its impact. Like you were saying, that there are other movies that you like as much, and for me, it's true... more so and more true in a way than just that, which is that if I were to make a list of the 10 best movies or the movies I consider the 10 greatest movies, Harold and Maude wouldn't be on it, because I don't think of it as a massively accomplished movie, but what it achieves is something beyond technique or innovative style, or it's just the emotional and the, dare I say, spiritual impact of it, which transcends the qualities of the movie itself, I think. In many ways, the movie is, I think you even said, quite conventional. I wouldn't necessarily use that word, but it, you know, it's not that remarkable scene by scene, and not like Vertigo, say, or all these movies that we recognize have just sort of changed the art form.
It
has something else, and it's quite mysterious to me, because Colin Higgins just doesn't, he's not a remarkable film figure. I have no interest in anything he did after that, although I've seen a lot of it. It's like he struck gold there, and it's kind of mysterious how he managed to create this such remarkable and unique expression of
I mean, he's an interesting figure, and a lot of his movies were, well, I mean, they, you know, a lot of them did quite well commercially after that, but Harold and Maude stands apart from the rest of them. You know, the rest of them are quite a bit more conventional and commercial seeming. I think it was a product of his age at that time. I mean, he was in graduate school. He was trying to, you know, come up with something that could be, you know, quite unique. And at the same time, I think he did realize at some point that it was it had a lot of potential. You know, it had a lot of commercial potential. When he expanded it, I'm sure he didn't realize, or you know, was surprised as anybody when it got picked up and made into a major feature film.
Mm.
You know, going from student film to feature, starring Ruth Gordon, and you know.
Yeah, that's very unusual in itself, even for that period, I would say. Because you have this Roger Corman school, where just nobodies get to make movies, but for a nobody to get their script made into a movie by a major studio is very, very rare.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's one of the things I wanted to cover in the book, and found out it, hello?
Yep, still there. Still here.
I found out about as much about it as I could, but, you know, his just happened to be at the right place at the right time and working for these people who were in the film community, and to be able to get the script to go straight to more or less Robert Evans' desk, you know. And I do think there was also an element of the fact that at the time so many movies were coming out of the woodwork and becoming quite unusual. Movies were becoming hits that the studios didn't understand exactly what the formula was, you know, but for a movie like Midnight Cowboy to become an enormous hit, and I use that quite a bit as an example, and Easy Rider, you know, these movies just came totally out of the blue, and they made millions and millions of dollars. So I think when Evans got the script, he looked at it and he went, you know, I better buy this.
Yeah.
I think it wasn't even so much that he loved the script. I think he thought, I better buy this because somebody else might get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a year from now, I don't want to be explaining to somebody why I passed on this thing that became a sensation, you know.
Right.
It's sort of sad to think, but, I mean, that is, you know, I would assume that's how a lot of these things happen, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, back then, anyway. Not so much now, I don't suppose.
I mean, from what I know of the film industry now, you know, there's kind of two kinds of movies that get made. The huge budget special effects spectacle, you know, that we all hear about that costs a couple $100 million to make, you know. And then there is sort of this indie circuit of movies that are, you know, much more akin to a movie like Harold and Maude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are financed by major film studios, or they're financed by arms of major film studios. But,
yeah,
you know, they don't spend a lot of money on them, and they put them into the festival circuit, and they hope to, you know, strike gold if the movie connects with audiences, you know. So it does kind of, you know, there is that element of it that still exists, but I mean, for Paramount, this was, you know, pretty major of a movie. It was a lower budget, you know, $1.5 million. It was a lower budget on the relative scale of ones compared to The Godfather and some of the other ones they were doing at the time. But, you know, it's still one of their films.
Still one of the 10 or 15 main releases of the year, I would think. No?
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is quite rare.
Yeah. So, what was your interest in Hal Ashby? Was it primarily because of Harold and Maude, or was it independent? Obviously, it wouldn't be independent, but how much of it was due to Harold and Maude?
It was somewhat due to Harold and Maude. It was just due to the fact that when I happened to be going to a lot of movies when I was in high school and college, that was his golden era. You know, that was his time. When he was making a lot of his great films, and I just happened to see Harold and Maude, Shampoo, The Last Detail, and then a little later Coming Home, and being there, you know, back to back to back to back almost. And it was the fact that not many people were talking about this guy, I mean, even back then, who was making all these great movies. He was, you know, given some acclaim. I mean, he was, you know, he did get an Academy Award nomination for Coming Home, but he was kind of a relatively under-the-radar figure, even back in the 70s, you know, compared to Polanski or some of the other ones, Coppola. You know, those guys were more well-known. me as a fan, as a film watcher, you know, to recognize, gee, here's this guy, Hal Ashby, you know. The movies are great, and they were kind of similar. You know, the movies themselves weren't that similar, but the characters in them were similar.
Mm.
The characters in them had sort of similar relations somewhat to each other, and you had this kind of, a lot of his main characters are like the Harold character. They're sort of naive kind of people who've been sort of they've been hurt sort of by the world, you know, and they're kind of they have trouble dealing with things, you know, so they're going through a lot of problems, and they're kind of anti-heroes in a sense. So, you know, he just, I don't know if it was he was picking those scripts or if they were coming to him because he was good at doing those kind of movies, but, you know, back to back to back, he made all these unique, interesting films with these really interesting characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I just always loved the guy, and, you know, thought that he got underrated quite a bit. He did die quite young, kind of before his time, so I think that was part of it. And a few years ago, a young writer named Nick Dawson wrote a biography of Hal Ashby, which was quite overdue. And when that came out, I was, you know, very glad to see that somebody had done it, you know. I wished I'd done it, but, you know, he was the one that sat down and wrote the book, and it's a great book. He's really well written. He researched it meticulously. So, but that kind of helped me, you know, prompt me to go, you know, gee, you know, you should figure out how to do something about this guy too, you know.
Hmm.
I don't know why that happens, but it does.
Yeah. The impression I have of Hal Ashby, and it's partly based on deduction and observation, but it's also partially based on things I've read and other people's opinions, I guess. I think it was Peter Biskind, because he includes stuff about Hal Ashby in Easy Rider's Raging
yeah.
Bull. I know that book's been criticized as being a lot of elaborate, you know, exaggerations and stuff, but I wouldn't know how to address that. But I think his take on Hal Ashby was that he was a casualty of the Hollywood system, that it ate him up and spat him out. What do you think about that view of Ashby?
Well, I think it you know, Peter Biskind's book, I mean, he's writing a book that somewhat is, I don't want to say sensationalizing, but I mean, it, to some extent, he's got to kind of put a story like that on someone like Hal's life so that it can be, you know, we can read it and go, oh, that's what happened. He was, you know.
Like he's writing a novel almost.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. It oversimplifies it in a sense, you know. And I think that was why it was good that Nick wrote his book, because it did counter some of that. I mean, I think it was good that in the Easy Rider's Raging Bulls that there was some attention focused to Hal, because there hadn't been much written about him, anything hardly written about him. So I think it was good that he wrote something about him. But I do think that the biography corrected some of the inaccuracies. I mean, I think there were some inaccuracies there. Hal Ashby was just a guy who he bucked the system, and when things were going right, they went right, but when things were going wrong, they went really wrong, you know.
Mm.
Because he didn't make any, he made a lot of enemies, you know. I guess that's a way to look at it, you know. He ruffled a lot of feathers because he was always wanting to do it, you know, his way. And when his way was working, it went great, but when his way wasn't working, he got no second chances, you know, whatsoever.
Mm. But that, I mean, that general description of a filmmaker who wants it his way and makes enemies and stuff, and it certainly reminds me of Sam Peckinpah, who's one I've looked at a lot. And you could also say he was a casualty of the Hollywood system in a different way, but in a similar way, actually. And in terms of his best films were sort of lumped together in a relatively short period, and then they just got worse and worse, and then he self-destructed through drugs. So there's some parallels there. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's definite parallels. I mean, I think Hal Ashby was worked better in the filmmaking system than Peckinpah did. I think Peckinpah was a bit more of a rebel, if that's a word or not. You know,
he made enemies. I mean, he consciously made people into enemies, I think.
Yeah. I think Hal would have liked to have, you know, not, you know, had those situations arise for him, but you know, they did.
But there's directors like Altman and Scorsese, and I'm not sure about Coppola, but maybe to some extent all of those different figures in the 70s, of which Ashby can be seen as one, albeit one with less obvious personality marked on the films. They all had this kind of rebellious thing, and they were always fighting with the studios to get their vision. And yet, many of those survived, at least as you pointed out in your book, to have a second act. They might have lost their way for a period, but then they managed to fight their way back to something. And Ashby and Peckinpah didn't. So, I mean, it suggests to me that it has something to do with... Because one thing about Peckinpah that's very interesting was that he created a persona that was very ornery and masculine and macho, but actually he was an incredibly sensitive person. And I think that that's what destroyed him, not just the effort of keeping up a persona that wasn't him, of course, would drain somebody, but the fact that he was so sensitive was that he just got so badly wounded through the process of just trying to constantly battle the studios and battle for his vision, that in the end he died of those wounds. So I think that's the sense I got with Ashby, rightly or wrongly, that he was just more sensitive than some of these other figures who just kind of developed rhino skins. And
I'm sure with Coppola that he was able to develop a thicker skin than someone like Hal Ashby or Sam Peckinpah. You know, I do think, yeah, those two probably were somewhat victims of their personality not functioning too well. But I think with Hal, it just, you know, he just got cancer. You know,
there is that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, once he got sick, you know, he passed away. You know, fairly quickly. I think if he hadn't gotten sick, I think he would have been able to get a renaissance, somewhat like some of these other guys have.
Mm.
You know, I think Altman and Coppola and, you know, Polanski went to Europe, of course, because he had to. But
yeah,
I mean, I think those guys they were able to take it a little bit better. But from all evidence, he was, you know, he was trying to get things in line and, you know, hoping to get some pictures that, you know, could bring him back. And taste changed quite a bit between the 70s and the 80s. And all of them had a hard time.
In the 80s,
The 80s, the pictures were, the audiences just, really quickly shifted to wanting different movies. You know, they wanted E.T. and they wanted Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars. You know, and those were radically different pictures than Harold and Maude and The Wild Bunch, and all those other ones. You know, so big change, and it was tough. But Hal Ashby's an interesting figure, and he has somewhat been embraced. You know, now in the last few years, by some people, there's a documentary is being made about his life, and I think that's probably going to come out pretty soon. And a filmmaker in Los Angeles, Amy Scott, is making a documentary about Hal's career. She has the interviews with people, and I think that's going to help really elevate his image, so to speak.
Do they have home movie footage and documentary footage of the film sets and that kind of thing to work with?
I don't know. She's done a lot of interviews, and I don't know what kind of archival. I doubt there's much home movie stuff, but I probably there is, yeah, stuff that was shot on sets. And I do know that there's a lot of there is some existence of, you know, multiple takes and outtakes and things like that for some of the films. I don't know if they exist that much for Harold and Maude, but I know, like, being there, there's a lot of outtake footage of Peter Sellers doing stuff, and I'm sure they have access to those kind of things. So I think it's going to be an interesting project.
Mm. Have you seen any of the Harold and Maude deleted scenes? Has anyone seen?
I haven't, no.
There's no DVD for that.
No, I don't. I think that a lot of that stuff, it was cut down quite a bit because it was, the first cut of the movie was 3 hours long.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess a lot of that stuff is just kind of goes the way of, you know, they didn't preserve it back then.
Right.
Mm. That's unfortunate, but anyway, I think that, you know, there's a lot going on now of younger people embracing these new Hollywood films, and so I think that's a great thing.
Mm.
For old people like me, you know, who remember them.
Yeah. So what's next for you, Jim? Are you going to write more books, or is this a one-off?
That's a good question. I'm kind of semi-retired now, and I am thinking about some other projects, but I don't have anything written in stone right at this time. I haven't started working on anything, so I've had a couple of thoughts of things that I might do, but nothing yet that I really put down on paper or started to do any research on. So I think I do want to do something, because it was a great experience with the Harold and Maude book, and you know, I'm probably going to give something else a shot, but nothing that I've started on right at this point.
You're waiting for the inspirational moment.
Yeah, the Harold and Maude thing was something that I really wanted to do for a long time, and to write a book and get it published. And at this point, if I'm going to jump in and do it again, I really want to make a commitment to it. And so, you know, really do it right. And so I'm kind of taking my time a little bit at this point before I settle on something. But I think there will be something.
Another movie that you would want to look more deeply into, you think?
I think so, yeah. My wife and I have just relocated to the Reno, Nevada area within the last couple of months. We were living in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is part of the reason I focused on Harold and Maude, because it was right there where we were living. But now we've relocated to Reno, so I'm up here, and I've thought about the movie The Misfits, which is a very interesting movie, which was shot up in this Northern Nevada area.
Mm.
And it's even older than Harold and Maude, of course. It came out in 1961, so that's crossed my mind as a possibility, but at this point I haven't done anything about it.
That's the movie that the whole cast died after making, isn't it?
Well, Marilyn Monroe died and Clark Gable died. Clark Gable died shortly after the movie finished production, yeah.
And Marilyn died about...
And Monty Quest died. He died about 5 years later, okay. I think.
So not immediately. Not but still it had that sort of aura around it, I remember, as sort of the Misfits curse. Yeah, I liked that movie a lot.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Yeah, it's another sort of interesting one that's got some interesting stories behind it, I think.
Yeah, it's a misfit movie, in fact.
Quite. Yeah.
thanks for talking to me today, Jim. And
my pleasure.
If people want to read their book, they can go to Amazon.com or the local bookshop or whatever, however they have to do to find it. But,
yeah, it's mostly sold online. McFarland, the publisher, is mostly online, so that's the best way to find it, is to go to Amazon. And it's available in a Kindle version. It's available on Barnes & Noble's website. It's got a Nook version, so...
Great. Okay, well, thanks, Jim.
Okay, Jason.